the Razak. They may try to slip past us and escape Helgrind through the entrance we used.
They probably have a bolt hole at ground level.
Probably, but I don't think they'll run quite yet. After what seemed like an hour trapped in the darkness, though Eragon knew it could not have been more than 10 or 15 minutes, and after descending more than 100 feet through Helgrind, Eragon stopped on a level patch of stone. Transmitting his thoughts to Roran, he said, Katrina's cell is about 50 feet in front of us, on the right. We can't risk letting her out until the Razak are dead or gone. What if they won't reveal themselves until we do let her out? For some reason, I can't sense them. They could hide from me until doomsday in here. So do we wait for who knows how long? Or do we free Katrina while we still have the chance? I can place some wards around her that should protect her from most attacks. Roran was quiet for a second. Let's free her then. They began to move forward again, feeling their way along the squat corridor with its rough, unfinished floor. Eragon had to devote most of his attention to his footing in order to maintain his balance. As a result, he almost missed the swish of cloth sliding over cloth, and then the faint twang that emanated from off to his right. He recoiled against the wall, shoving Roran back. At the same time, something augured past his face, carving a groove of flesh from his right cheek. The thin trench burned as if cauterized.
Kveikva!
Shouted Eragon. Red light, bright as the midday sun, flared into existence. It had no source, and thus it illuminated every surface evenly and without shadows, giving things a curious, flat appearance. The sudden blaze dazzled Eragon, but it did more than that to the lone Razak in front of him. The creature dropped its bow, covered its hooded face, and screamed, high and shrill. A similar screech told Eragon that the second Razak was behind them.
Roran!
Eragon pivoted just in time to see Roran charge the other Razak, hammer held high. The disoriented monster stumbled backward, but was too slow. The hammer fell.
For my father!
Shouted Roran. He struck again.
For our home!
The Razak was already dead, but Roran lifted the hammer once more.
For Carvajal!
His final blow shattered the Razak's carapace like the rind of a dry gourd. In the merciless ruby glare, the spreading pool of blood appeared purple. Spinning his staff in a circle to knock aside the arrow or sword that he was convinced was driving toward him, Eragon turned to confront the remaining Razak. The tunnel before them was empty. He swore. Eragon strode over to the twisted figure on the floor. He swung the staff over his head and brought it down across the chest of the dead Razak with a resounding thud.
I've waited a long time to do that, said Eragon.
As have I. He and Roran looked at each other.
Ah! Cried Eragon, and clutched his cheek as the pain intensified. It's bubbling, exclaimed Roran. Do something! The Razak must have coated the arrowhead with Sether oil, thought Eragon.
Remembering his training, he cleansed the wound and surrounding tissue with an incantation, and then repaired the damage to his face. He opened and closed his mouth several times to make sure the muscles were working properly. With a grim smile, he said, Imagine the state we'd be in without magic. Without magic, we wouldn't have Galbatorix to worry about.
Talk later, said Saphira. As soon as those fishermen reach Dras Leona, the king may hear of our doings from one of his pet spellcasters in the city. And we do not want Galbatorix scrying Helgrind while we are still here.
Yes, yes,
said Eragon. Extinguishing the omnipresent red glow, he said,
Brisinger Rauder,
and created a red wheelite like that from the previous night, except that this one remained anchored 6 inches from the ceiling, instead of accompanying Eragon wherever he went. Now that he had an opportunity to examine the tunnel in some detail, Eragon saw that the stone hallway was dotted with 20 or so iron-bound doors, some on either side. He pointed and said, 9th down on the right,
You go get her. I'll check the other cells. The Razak might have left something interesting in them.
Roran nodded. Crouching, he searched the corpse at their feet, but found no keys. He shrugged.
I'll do it the hard way, then.
He sprinted to the proper door, abandoned his shield, and set to work on the hinges with his hammer. Each blow created a frightful crash. Aragorn did not offer to help. His cousin would not want or appreciate assistance now, and besides, there was something else Aragorn had to do. He went to the first cell, whispered three words, then, after the lock snapped open, pushed aside the door. All that the small room contained was a black chain and a pile of rotting bones. Those sad remains were no more than he had expected. He already knew where the object of his search lay, but he maintained the charade of ignorance to avoid kindling Roran's suspicion. Two more doors opened and closed beneath the touch of Aragorn's fingers. Then at the fourth cell, the door swung back to admit the shifting radiance of the Weirlight and reveal the very man Aragorn had hoped he would not find. Sloane. Divergence. The butcher sat slumped against the left-hand wall, both arms chained to an iron ring above his head. His ragged clothes barely covered his pale, emaciated body. The corners of his bones stood out in sharp relief underneath his translucent skin. His blue veins were also prominent. Sores had formed on his wrists where the manacles chafed. The ulcers oozed a mixture of clear fluid and blood. What remained of his hair had turned grey or white and hung in lank, greasy ropes over his pockmarked face. Roused by the clang of Roran's hammer, Sloane lifted his chin toward the light and in a quavering voice asked,
"Who is it? Who's there?"
His hair parted and slid back, exposing his eye sockets, which had sunk deep into his skull. Where his eyelids should have been, there were now only a few scraps of tattered skin draped over the raw cavities underneath. The area around them was bruised and scabbed. With a shock, Aragorn realized that the Razak had pecked out Sloane's eyes. What he then should do, Aragorn could not decide. The butcher had told the Razak that Aragorn had found Saphira's egg. Furthermore, Sloane had murdered the watchman, Bird, and had betrayed Carvajal to the Empire. If he were brought before his fellow villagers, they would undoubtedly find Sloane guilty and condemn him to death by hanging. It seemed only right to Aragorn that the butcher should die for his crimes. That was not the source of his uncertainty. Rather, it arose from the fact that Roran loved Katrina. And Katrina, whatever Sloane had done, must still harbour a certain degree of affection for her father. Watching an arbitrator publicly denounce Sloane's offences and then hang him would be no easy thing for her, or, by extension, Roran. Such hardship might even create enough ill will between them to end their engagement. Either way, Aragorn was convinced that taking Sloane back with them would sow discord between him, Roran, Katrina, and the other villagers, and might engender enough anger to distract them from their struggle against the Empire.
The easiest solution, thought Aragorn, would be to kill him, and say that I found him dead in the cell.
His lips trembled. One of the death words heavy upon his tongue.
What do you want?
Asked Sloane. He turned his head from side to side in an attempt to hear better.
I already told you everything I know.
Aragorn cursed himself for hesitating. Sloane's guilt was not in dispute. He was a murderer and a traitor. Any lawgiver would sentence him to execution. Notwithstanding the merit of those arguments, it was Sloane who was curled in front of him, a man Aragorn had known his entire life. The butcher might be a despicable person, but the wealth of memories and experiences Aragorn shared with him bred a sense of intimacy that troubled Aragorn's conscience.
To strike down Sloane would be like raising his hand against Horst or Loring or any of the elders of Carvajal. Again Aragorn prepared to utter the fatal word. An image appeared in his mind's eye. Torkenbrand, the slaver he and Murtagh had encountered during their flight to the Varden, kneeling on the dusty ground, and Murtagh striding up to him and beheading him. Aragorn remembered how he had objected to Murtagh's deed, and how it had troubled him for days afterward. "Have I changed so much?" he asked himself, "that I can do the same thing now? As Roran said, I have killed, but only in the heat of battle. Never like this." He glanced over his shoulder as Roran broke the last hinge to Katrina's cell door. Dropping his hammer, Roran prepared to charge the door and knock it inward, but then appeared to think better of it, and tried to lift it free of its frame. The door rose a fraction of an inch, then halted and wobbled in his grip. "Give me a hand here," he shouted. "I don't want it to fall on her." Aragorn looked back at the wretched butcher. He had no more time for mindless wanderings. He had to choose. One way or another, he had to choose. "Aragorn!" "I don't know what's right," realized Aragorn. His own uncertainty told him that it would be wrong to kill Sloane or return him to the Varden. He had no idea what he should do instead, except to find a third path. One that was less obvious and less violent. Lifting his hand as if in benediction, Aragorn whispered, "Slither." Sloane's manacles rattled as he went limp, falling into a profound sleep. As soon as he was sure the spell had taken hold, Aragorn closed and locked the cell door again, and replaced his wards around it.
"What are you up to, Aragorn?" asked Saphira.
"Wait until we're together again. I'll explain then."
"Explain what? You don't have a plan."
"Give me a minute and I will."
"What was in there?" asked Roran, as Aragorn took his place opposite him.
"Sloane." Aragorn adjusted his grip on the door between them. "He's dead." Roran's eyes widened.
"How?"
"Looks like they broke his neck."
For an instant Aragorn feared that Roran might not believe him. Then his cousin grunted and said, "It's better that way, I suppose. Ready? One, two, three."
Together they heaved the massive door out of its casing and threw it across the hallway. The stone passageway returned the resulting boom to them again and again. Without pause, Roran rushed into the cell, which was lit by a single wax taper. Aragorn followed a step behind. Katrina cowered at the far end of an iron cot.
"Let me alone, you toothless bastards! I—"
She stopped, struck dumb, as Roran stepped forward. Her face was white from lack of sun and streaked with filth, yet at that moment a look of such wonder and tender love blossomed upon her features. Aragorn thought he had rarely seen anyone so beautiful. Never taking her eyes off Roran, Katrina stood and with a shaking hand touched his cheek.
"You came."
"I came." A laughing sob broke out of Roran, and he folded her in his arms, pulling her against his chest. They remained lost in their embrace for a long moment. Drawing back, Roran kissed her three times on the lips. Katrina wrinkled her nose and exclaimed,
"You grew a beard."
Of all the things she could have said, that was so unexpected, and she sounded so shocked and surprised, that Aragorn chuckled in response. For the first time, Katrina seemed to notice him. She glanced him over, then settled on his face, which she studied with evident puzzlement.
"Aragorn? Is that you?"
"Aye. He's a dragon rider now," said Roran.
"A rider? You mean—"
she faltered. The revelation seemed to overwhelm her. Glancing at Roran as if for protection, she held him even closer and sidled around him away from Aragorn. To Roran she said,
"How did you find us? Who else is with you?"
all that later. We have to get out of Hellgrind before the rest of the Empire comes running after us.
Wait, what about my father? Did you find him?
Roran looked at Aragorn, then returned his gaze to Katrina and gently said, "We were too late." A shiver ran through Katrina. She closed her eyes and a solitary tear leaked down the side of her face.
So be it.
While they spoke, Aragorn frantically tried to figure out how to dispose of Sloane, although he concealed his deliberations from Saphira. He knew that she would disapprove of the direction his thoughts were taking. A scheme began to form in his mind. It was an outlandish concept, fraught with danger and uncertainty, but it was the only viable path, given the circumstances. Abandoning further reflection, Aragorn sprang into action. He had much to do in little time. "Geirda!" he cried, pointing. With a burst of blue sparks and flying fragments, the metal bands riveted around Katrina's ankles broke apart. Katrina jumped in surprise.
"Magic," she whispered.
"A simple spell." She shrank from his touch as he reached toward her.
"Katrina, I have to make sure that Galbatorix or one of his magicians hasn't enchanted you with any traps or forced you to swear things in the ancient language."
"The ancient—" Roran interrupted her. "Aragorn, do this when we make camp. We can't stay here."
"No."
Aragorn slashed his arm through the air. "We do it now." Scowling, Roran moved aside and allowed Aragorn to put his hands on Katrina's shoulders.
"Just look into my eyes," he told her.
She nodded and obeyed. That was the first time Aragorn had a reason to use the spells Oromis had taught him for detecting the work of another spellcaster, and he had difficulty remembering every word from the scrolls in Ellesmere. The gaps in his memory were so serious that on three different instances he had to rely upon a synonym to complete an incantation. For a long while Aragorn stared into Katrina's glistening eyes and mouthed phrases in the ancient language, occasionally, and with her permission, examining one of her memories for evidence that someone had tampered with it. He was as gentle as possible, unlike the twins, who had ravaged his own mind in a similar procedure the day he arrived at Farthendur. Roran stood guard, pacing back and forth in front of the open doorway. Every second that went by increased his agitation. He twirled his hammer and tapped the head of it against his upper thigh, as if keeping time with a piece of music. At last, Aragorn released Katrina. "I'm done."
"What did you find?" she whispered.
She hugged herself, her forehead creased with worry lines as she waited for his verdict. Silence filled the cell as Roran came to a standstill.
"Nothing but your own thoughts. You are free of any spells."
"Of course she is," growled Roran, and again wrapped her in his arms.
Together, the three of them exited the cell.
"Brisingr, Eat Tauther," said Aragorn,
gesturing at the weirlight that still floated near the ceiling of the hallway. At his command, the glowing orb darted to a spot directly over his head and remained there, bobbing like a piece of driftwood in the surf. Aragorn took the lead as they hurried back through the jumble of tunnels toward the cavern where they had landed. As he trotted across the slick rock, he watched for the remaining Razak, while at the same time erecting wards to safeguard Katrina. Behind him, he heard her and Roran exchange a series of brief phrases and lone words.
"I love you."
"Horst and others safe."
"Always."
"For you."
"Yes. Yes.
Yes. Yes." The trust and affection they shared were so obvious, it roused a dull ache of longing inside Aragorn. When they were about 10 yards from the main cavern, and could just begin to see by the faint glow ahead of them, Aragorn extinguished the weirlight. A few feet later, Katrina slowed, then pressed herself against the side of the tunnel and covered her face.
"I can't. It's too bright. My eyes hurt."
Roran quickly moved in front of her, casting her in his shadow.
"When was the last time you were outside?"
"I don't know."
A hint of panic crept into her voice.
I don't know. Not since they brought me here. Roran, am I going blind?
She sniffed and began to cry. Her tears surprised Aragorn. He remembered her as someone of great strength and fortitude. But then she had spent many weeks locked in the dark, fearing for her life. I might not be myself either, if I were in her place. No, you're fine. You just need to get used to the sun again. Roran stroked her hair. Come on, don't let this upset you. Everything is going to be all right. You're safe now. Safe, Katrina, you hear me?
I hear you.
Although he hated to ruin one of the tunics the elves had given him, Aragorn tore off a strip of cloth from the bottom edge of his garment. He handed it to Katrina and said, "Tie this over your eyes. You should be able to see through it well enough to keep from falling or running into anything." She thanked him, and then blindfolded herself. Once again advancing, the trio emerged into the sunny, blood-splattered main cavern, which stank worse than before owing to the noxious fumes that drifted from the body of the Leatherblucker, even as Saphira appeared from within the depths of the lancet opening opposite them. Seeing her, Katrina gasped and clung to Roran, digging her fingers into his arms. Aragorn said, "Katrina, allow me to introduce you to Saphira. I am her rider. She can understand if you speak to her."
"It is an honor, O dragon," Katrina managed to say.
She dipped her knees in a weak imitation of a curtsy. Saphira inclined her head in return. Then she faced Aragorn.
"I searched the Leatherblacker's nest, but all I found was bones, bones, and more bones, including several that smelled of fresh meat. The Razak must have eaten the slaves last night."
"I wish we could have rescued them."
"I know, but we cannot protect everyone in this war."
Gesturing at Saphira, Aragorn said, "Go on. Climb onto her. I'll join you in a moment." Katrina hesitated, then glanced at Roran, who nodded and murmured, "It's all right. Saphira brought us here." Together, the couple skirted the corpse of the Leatherblucker as they went over to Saphira, who crouched flat upon her belly so that they could mount her. Cupping his hands to form a step, Roran lifted Katrina high enough to pull herself over the upper part of Saphira's left foreleg. From there, Katrina clambered the looped leg straps of the saddle as if a ladder, until she sat perched upon the crest of Saphira's shoulders. Like a mountain goat leaping from one ledge to another, Roran duplicated her ascent. Crossing the cave after them, Aragorn examined Saphira, assessing the severity of her various scrapes, gashes, tears, bruises, and stab wounds. To do so, he relied upon what she herself felt, in addition to what he could see.
"For goodness sake," said Saphira, "save your attentions until we are well out of danger. I'm not going to bleed to death."
"That's not quite true, and you know it. You're bleeding inside. Unless I stop it now, you may suffer complications I can't heal, and then we'll never get back to the Varden. Don't argue. You can't change my mind, and I won't take a minute." As it turned out, Aragorn required several minutes to restore Saphira to her former health. Her injuries were severe enough that in order to complete his spells, he had to empty the belt of Belote the Wise of energy, and after that, draw upon Saphira's own vast reserves of strength. Whenever he shifted from a larger wound to a smaller one, she protested that he was being foolish, and would he please leave off? But he ignored her complaints, much to her growing displeasure. Afterward, Aragorn slumped, tired from the magic and the fighting. Flicking a finger toward the places where the Leatherblucker had skewered her with their beaks, he said, "You should have Arya or another elf inspect my handiwork on those. I did my best, but I may have missed something."
"I appreciate your concern for my welfare," she replied, "but this is hardly the place for soft-hearted demonstrations. Once and for all, let us be gone."
"Aye,
Time to leave. Stepping back, Aragorn edged away from Saphira, in the direction of the tunnel behind him.
Come on, called Roran. Hurry up!
Aragorn!
Exclaimed Saphira. Aragorn shook his head. No, I'm staying here.
You?
Roran started to say, but a ferocious growl from Saphira interrupted him. She lashed her tail against the side of the cave and raked the floor with her talons, so that bone and stone squealed in what sounded like mortal agony.
Listen, shouted Aragorn. One of the Razak is still on the loose, and think what else might be in Hellgrind. Scrolls, potions, information about the Empire's activities, things that can help us. The Razak may even have eggs of theirs stored here. If they do, I have to destroy them before Galbatorix can claim them for his own.
To Saphira, Aragorn also said, I can't kill Sloane. I can't let Roran or Katrina see him, and I can't allow him to starve to death in his cell or Galbatorix's men to recapture him. I'm sorry, but I have to deal with Sloane on my own.
How will you get out of the Empire? Demanded Roran.
I'll run. I'm as fast as an elf now, you know.
The tip of Saphira's tail twitched. That was the only warning Aragorn had before she leaped toward him, extending one of her glittering paws. He fled, dashing into the tunnel a fraction of a second before Saphira's foot passed through the space where he had been. Saphira skidded to a stop in front of the tunnel and roared with frustration that she was unable to follow him into the narrow enclosure. Her bulk blocked most of the light. The stone shook around Aragorn as she tore at the entrance with her claws and teeth, breaking off thick chunks. Her feral snarls and the sight of her lunging muzzle, filled with teeth as long as his forearm, sent a jolt of fear through Aragorn. He understood then how a rabbit must feel when it cowers in its den while a wolf digs after it.
Ganga!
He shouted.
No!
Saphira placed her head on the ground and uttered a mournful keen, her eyes large and pitiful.
Ganga! I love you, Saphira, but you have to go!
She retreated several yards from the tunnel and snuffled at him, mewling like a cat.
Little one!
Aragorn hated to make her unhappy, and he hated to send her away. It felt as if he were tearing himself apart. Saphira's misery flowed across their mental link, and coupled with his own anguish, almost paralyzed him. Somehow he mustered the nerve to say,
Ganga! And don't come back for me or send anyone else for me. I'll be fine. Ganga! Ganga!
Saphira howled with frustration, and then reluctantly walked to the mouth of the cave. From his place on her saddle, Roran said,
Aragorn, come on! Don't be daft! You're too important to risk...
A combination of noise and motion obscured the rest of his sentence as Saphira launched herself out of the cave. In the clear sky beyond, her scales sparkled like a multitude of brilliant blue diamonds. She was, Aragorn thought, magnificent, proud, noble, and more beautiful than any other living creature. No stag or lion could compete with the majesty of a dragon in flight. She said,
A week! That is how long I shall wait. Then I shall return for you, Aragorn, even if I must fight my way past Thorn, Shrooken, and 1,000 magicians.
Aragorn stood there until she dwindled from sight and he could no longer touch her mind. Then, his heart heavy as lead, he squared his shoulders and turned away from the sun and all things bright and living, and once more descended into the tunnels of shadow. Rider and Razak. Aragorn sat, bathed in the heatless radiance from his crimson wheelite, in the hall lined with cells near the center of Hellgrind. His staff lay across his lap. The rock reflected his voice as he repeated a phrase in the ancient language over and over again. It was not magic, but rather a message to the remaining Razak. What he said meant this. Come, O thou eater of men's flesh, let us end this fight of ours. You are hurt and I am weary, your companions are dead and I am alone. We are a fit match. I promise that I shall not use gramarye against you, nor hurt or trap you with spells I have already cast. Come, O thou eater of men's flesh, let us end this fight of ours. The time during which he spoke seemed endless. A never when, in a ghastly, tinted chamber that remained unchanged through an eternity of cycling words whose order and significance ceased to matter to him. After a time his clamoring thoughts fell silent, and a strange calm crept over him. He paused with his mouth open, then closed it, watchful. 30 feet in front of him stood the Razak. Blood dripped from the hem of the creature's ragged robes.
My master does not want me to kill you, it hissed.
But that does not matter to you now.
No. If I fall to your staff, let Galbatorix deal with you as he will. He has more hearts than you do.
Aragorn laughed. Hearts? I am the champion of the people, not him.
Foolish boy.
The Razak cocked its head slightly, looking past him at the corpse of the other Razak, farther up the tunnel.
She was my hatchmate. You have become strong since we first met, Shadeslayer.
It was that, or die.
Will you make a pact with me, Shadeslayer?
What kind of a pact?
I am the last of my race, Shadeslayer. We are ancient, and I would not have us forgotten. Would you, in your songs and in your histories, remind your fellow humans of the terror we inspired in your kind? Remember us as fear.
Why should I do that for you? Tucking its beak against its narrow chest, the Razak clucked and chittered to itself for several moments.
Because, it said, I will tell you something secret. Yes, I will.
Then tell me.
Give me your word first, lest you trick me.
No, tell me, and then I will decide whether or not to agree. Over a minute passed, and neither of them moved, although Aragorn kept his muscles taut and ready in expectation of a surprise attack. After another squall of sharp clicks, the Razak said,
He has almost found the name.
Who has?
Galbatorix.
The name of what?
The Razak hissed with frustration. I cannot tell you. The name. The true name.
You have to give me more information than that.
I cannot.
Then we have no pact.
Curse you, rider. I curse you. May you find no roost, nor den, nor peace of mind in this land of yours. May you leave Alagazia and never return.
The nape of Aragorn's neck prickled with the cold touch of dread. In his mind, he again heard the words of Angela the herbalist, when she had cast her dragon bones for him and told his fortune and predicted that self-same fate. A mare's tail of blood separated Aragorn from his enemy as the Razak swept back its sodden cloak, revealing a bow that it held with an arrow already fit to the string. Lifting and drawing the weapon, the Razak loosed the bolt in the direction of Aragorn's chest. Aragorn batted the shaft aside with his staff. As if this attempt were nothing more than a preliminary gesture,
but custom dictated they observe before proceeding with their actual confrontation. The Razak stooped, placed the bow on the floor, then straightened its cowl, and slowly and deliberately pulled its leaf-bladed sword from underneath its robes. While it did, Aragorn rose to his feet and took a shoulder-wide stance, his hands tight on the staff. They lunged toward each other. The Razak attempted to cleave Aragorn from collarbone to hip, but Aragorn twisted and stepped past the blow. Jamming the end of the staff upward, he drove its metal spike underneath the Razak's beak and through the plates that protected the creature's throat. The Razak shuddered once, and then collapsed. Aragorn stared at his most hated foe, stared at its lidless black eyes, and suddenly he went weak at the knees and retched against the wall of the corridor. Wiping his mouth, he yanked the staff free and whispered, "For our father, for our home, for Carvajal, for Brom, I have had my fill of vengeance. May you rot here forever, Razak." Going to the appropriate cell, Aragorn retrieved Sloane, who was still deep in his enchanted sleep, slung the butcher over his shoulder, and then began to retrace his steps back to the main cave of Helgrind. Along the way, he often lowered Sloane to the floor and left him, to explore a chamber or byway that he had not visited before. In them, he discovered many evil instruments, including 4 metal flasks of Seether oil, which he promptly destroyed, so that no one else could use the flesh-eating acid to further their malicious plans. Hot sunlight stung Aragorn's cheeks when he stumbled out of the network of tunnels. Holding his breath, he hurried past the dead Leatherblocker and went to the edge of the vast cave, where he gazed down the precipitous side of Helgrind at the hills far below. To the west, he saw a pillar of orange dust billowing above the lane that connected Helgrind to Dras Leona, marking the approach of a group of horsemen. His right side was burning from supporting Sloane's weight, so Aragorn shifted the butcher onto his other shoulder. He blinked away the beads of sweat that clung to his eyelashes as he struggled to solve the problem of how he was supposed to transport Sloane and himself 5,000-some feet to the ground. "It's almost a mile down," he murmured. "If there were a path, I could easily walk that distance, even with Sloane. So I must have the strength to lower us with magic. Yes, but what you can do over a length of time may be too taxing to accomplish all at once without killing yourself. As Oromis said, the body cannot convert its stockpile of fuel into energy fast enough to sustain most spells for more than a few seconds. I only have a certain amount of power available at any given moment, and once it's gone, I have to wait until I recover. And talking to myself isn't getting me anywhere." Securing his hold on Sloane, Aragorn fixed his eyes on a narrow ledge about 100 feet below. "This is going to hurt," he thought, preparing himself for the attempt. Then he barked, "Audr!" Aragorn felt himself rise several inches above the floor of the cave. "Fram," he said, and the spell propelled him away from Helgrind and into open space, where he hung unsupported, like a cloud drifting in the sky. Accustomed as he was to flying with Saphira, the sight of nothing but thin air underneath his feet still caused him unease. By manipulating the flow of magic, Aragorn quickly descended from the Razak's lair, which the insubstantial wall of stone once again hid, to the ledge. His boot slipped on a loose piece of rock as he alighted. For a handful of breathless seconds he flailed, searching for solid footing, but unable to look down, as tilting his head could send him toppling forward. He yelped as his left leg went off the ledge and he began to fall. Before he could resort to magic to save himself, he came to an abrupt halt as his left foot wedged itself in a crevice. The edges of the rift dug into his calf behind his greave, but he did not mind, for it held him in place. Aragorn leaned his back against Helgrind, using it to help him prop up Sloane's limp body. "That wasn't too bad," he observed.
The effort had cost him, but not so much that he was unable to continue.
"I can do this," he said. He gulped fresh air into his lungs, waiting for his racing heart to slow. He felt as if he had sprinted a score of yards while carrying Sloane. "I can do this."
The approaching riders caught his eye again. They were noticeably closer than before, and galloping across the dry land at a pace that worried him.
"It's a race between them and me," he realized. "I have to escape before they reach Hellgrind. There are sure to be magicians among them, and I'm in no fit condition to duel Galbatorix's spellcasters."
Glancing over at Sloane's face, he said,
"Perhaps you can help me a bit, eh? It's the least you can do, considering I'm risking death and worse for you."
The sleeping butcher rolled his head, lost in the world of dreams. With a grunt, Eragon pushed himself off Hellgrind. Again he said, "Audr," and again he became airborne. This time he relied upon Sloane's strength, meager as it was, as well as his own. Together they sank like two strange birds along Hellgrind's rugged flank, toward another ledge, whose width promised safe haven. In such a manner, Eragon orchestrated their downward climb. He did not proceed in a straight line, but rather angled off to his right, so that they curved around Hellgrind, and the mass of blocky stone hid him and Sloane from the horsemen. The closer they got to the ground, the slower they went. A crushing fatigue overcame Eragon, reducing the distance he was able to traverse in a single stretch, and making it increasingly difficult for him to recuperate during the pauses between his bursts of exertion. Even lifting a finger became a task that he found irritating in the extreme, as well as one that was almost unbearably laborious. Drowsiness muffled him in its warm folds, and dulled his thoughts and feelings until the hardest of rocks seemed as soft as pillows to his aching muscles. When he finally dropped onto the sun-baked soil, too weak to keep Sloane and himself from ramming into the dirt, Eragon lay with his arms folded at odd angles underneath his chest, and stared with half-lidded eyes into the yellow flecks of citrine embedded within the small rock an inch or two from his nose. Sloane weighed on his back like a pile of iron ingots. Air seeped from Eragon's lungs, but none seemed to return. His vision darkened as if a cloud had covered the sun. A deadly lull separated each beat of his heart, and the throb, when it came, was no more than a faint flutter. Eragon was no longer capable of coherent thought, but somewhere in the back of his brain he was aware that he was about to die. It did not frighten him. To the contrary, the prospect comforted him, for he was tired beyond belief, and death would free him from the battered shell of his flesh and allow him to rest for all of eternity. From above and behind his head there came a bumblebee as big as his thumb. It circled his ear, then hovered by the rock, probing the nodes of citrine, which were the same bright yellow as the field stars that bloomed among the hills. The bumblebee's mane glowed in the morning light, each hair sharp and distinct to Eragon, and its blurred wings generated a gentle bombulation, like a tattoo played on a drum. Pollen powdered the bristles on its legs. The bumblebee was so vibrant, so alive, and so beautiful. Its presence renewed Eragon's will to survive. A world that contained a creature as amazing as that bumblebee was a world he wanted to live in. By sheer force of will, he pushed his left hand free of his chest and grasped the woody stem of a nearby shrub. Like a leech or a tick or some other parasite, he extracted the life from the plant, leaving it limp and brown. The subsequent rush of energy that coursed through Eragon sharpened his wits. Now he was scared. Having regained his desire to continue existing, he found nothing but terror in the blackness beyond. Dragging himself forward, he seized another shrub and transferred its vitality into his body, then a third shrub and a fourth shrub, and so on, until he once again possessed the full measure of his strength. He stood and looked back at the trail of brown plants that stretched out behind him. A bitter taste filled his mouth as he saw what he had wrought. Aragorn knew that he had been careless with the magic, and that his reckless behavior would have doomed the Varden to certain defeat if he had died. In hindsight, his stupidity made him wince. "Brom would box my ears for getting into this mess," he thought. Returning to Sloane, Aragorn hoisted the gaunt butcher off the ground. Then he turned east and loped away from Helgrind and into the concealment of a draw. 10 minutes later, when he paused to check for pursuers, he saw a cloud of dirt swirling at the base of Helgrind, which he took to mean that the horsemen had arrived at the dark tower of stone. He smiled. Galbatorix's minions were too far away for any lesser magicians among their ranks to detect his or Sloane's minds. "By the time they discover the Razak's bodies," he thought, "I shall have run a league or more. I doubt they will be able to find me then. Besides, they will be searching for a dragon and her rider, not a man travelling on foot." Satisfied that he did not have to worry about an imminent attack, Aragorn resumed his previous pace, a steady, effortless stride that he could maintain for the entire day. Above him the sun gleamed gold and white. Before him, trackless wilderness extended for many leagues before lapping against the outbuildings of some village. And in his heart, a new joy and hope flared. At last, the Razak were dead! At last his quest for vengeance was complete. At last he had fulfilled his duty to Garrow and to Brom. And at last he had cast off the pall of fear and anger that he had labored beneath ever since the Razak first appeared in Carvajal. Killing them had taken far longer than he expected, but now the deed was done. And a mighty deed it was. He allowed himself to revel in satisfaction over having accomplished such a difficult feat, albeit with assistance from Roran and Saphira. Yet, to his surprise, his triumph was bittersweet, tainted by an unexpected sense of loss. His hunt for the Razak had been one of his last ties to his life in Palancar Valley, and he was loath to relinquish that bond, gruesome as it was. Moreover, the task had given him a purpose in life when he had none. It was the reason why he had originally left his home. Without it, a hole gaped inside of him where he had nurtured his hate for the Razak. That he could mourn the end of such a terrible mission appalled Aragorn, and he vowed to avoid making the same mistake twice. "I refuse to become so attached to my struggle against the Empire and Murtag and Galbatorix that I won't want to move on to something else, when and if the time comes. Or worse, that I'll try to prolong the conflict rather than adapt to whatever happens next." He chose then to push away his misbegotten regret, and to concentrate instead on his relief. Relief that he was free of the grim demands of his self-imposed quest, and that his only remaining obligations were those born of his current position. Elation lightened his steps. With the Razak gone, Aragorn felt as if he could finally make a life for himself, based not on who he had been, but on who he had become. A dragon rider. He smiled at the uneven horizon and laughed as he ran, indifferent as to whether anyone might hear him. His voice rolled up and down the draw and around him. Everything seemed new and beautiful and full of promise. To walk the land alone. Aragorn's stomach gurgled. He was lying on his back, legs folded under at the knees, stretching his thighs after running farther and with more weight than he ever had before, when the loud, liquid rumble erupted from his innards. The sound was so unexpected, Aragorn bolted upright, groping for his staff. Wind whistled across the empty land. The sun had set,
and in its absence everything was blue and purple. Nothing moved, save for the blades of grass that fluttered, and Sloane, whose fingers slowly opened and closed, in response to some vision in his enchanted slumber. A bone-biting cold heralded the arrival of true night. Aragorn relaxed, and allowed himself a small smile. His amusement soon vanished as he considered the source of his discomfort. Battling the Razak, casting numerous spells and bearing Sloane upon his shoulders for most of the day, had left Aragorn so ravenous he imagined that if he could travel back in time, he could eat the entire feast the dwarves had cooked in his honour during his visit to Tarnag. The memory of how the roast Nagra, the giant boar, had smelled. Hot, pungent, seasoned with honey and spices and dripping with lard, was enough to make his mouth water. The problem was he had no supplies. Water was easy enough to come by. He could draw moisture from the soil whenever he wanted. Finding food in that desolate place, however, was not only far more difficult, it presented him with a moral dilemma that he had hoped to avoid. Oromis had devoted many of his lessons to the various climates and geographic regions that existed throughout Alagaesia. Thus, when Aragorn left their camp to investigate the surrounding area, he was able to identify most of the plants he encountered. Few were edible, and of those none were large or bountiful enough for him to gather a meal for two grown men in a reasonable amount of time. The local animals were sure to have hidden away caches of seeds and fruit, but he had no idea where to begin searching for them. Nor did he think it was likely that a desert mouse would have amassed more than a few mouthfuls of food. That left him with two options, neither of which appealed to him. He could, as he had before, drain the energy from the plants and insects around their camp. The price of doing so would be to leave a death spot upon the earth, a blight where nothing, not even the tiny organisms in the soil, still lived. And while it might keep him and Sloane on their feet, transfusions of energy were far from satisfying, as they did nothing to fill one's stomach. Or he could hunt. Aragorn scowled and twisted the butt of his staff into the ground. After sharing the thoughts and desires of numerous animals, it revolted him to consider eating one. Nevertheless, he was not about to weaken himself and perhaps allow the Empire to capture him, just because he went without supper in order to spare the life of a rabbit. As both Saphira and Roran had pointed out, every living thing survived by eating something else. Ours is a cruel world, he thought, and I cannot change how it is made. The elves may be right to avoid flesh, but at the moment my need is great. I refuse to feel guilty if circumstances drive me to this. It is not a crime to enjoy some bacon or a trout or what have you. He continued to reassure himself with various arguments, yet disgust at the concept still squirmed within his gut. For almost half an hour he remained rooted to the spot, unable to do what logic told him was necessary. Then he became aware of how late it was, and swore at himself for wasting time. He needed every minute of rest he could get. Steeling himself, Aragorn sent out tendrils from his mind, and probed the land, until he located two large lizards, and curled in a sandy den, a colony of rodents that reminded him of a cross between a rat, a rabbit, and a squirrel. "Deya," said Aragorn, and killed the lizards and one of the rodents. They died instantly and without pain, but he still gritted his teeth as he extinguished the bright flames of their minds. The lizards he retrieved by hand, flipping over the rocks they had been hiding underneath. The rodent, however, he extracted from the den with magic. He was careful to not wake the other animals as he maneuvered the body up to the surface. It seemed cruel to terrify them with the knowledge that an invisible predator could kill them in their most secret havens. He gutted, skinned, and otherwise cleaned the lizards and rodent, burying the offal deep enough to hide it from scavengers. Gathering thin, flat stones, he built a small oven, lit a fire within, and started the meat cooking. Without salt, he could not properly season any sort of food, but some of the native plants released a pleasant smell when he crushed them between his fingers, and those he rubbed over and packed into the carcasses. The rodent was ready first, being smaller than the lizards. Lifting it off the top of the makeshift oven, Aragorn held the meat in front of his mouth. He grimaced and would have remained locked in the grip of his revulsion, except that he had to continue tending the fire and the lizards. Those two activities distracted him enough that without thinking, he obeyed the strident command of his hunger, and ate. The initial bite was the worst. It stuck in his throat, and the taste of hot grease threatened to make him sick. Then he shivered and dry-swallowed twice, and the urge passed. After that, it was easier. He was actually grateful the meat was rather bland, for the lack of flavor helped him to forget what he was chewing. He consumed the entire rodent, and then part of a lizard. Tearing the last bit of flesh off a thin leg bone, he heaved a sigh of contentment, and then hesitated. Chagrined to realize that in spite of himself, he had enjoyed the meal. He was so hungry, the meager supper had seemed delicious once he overcame his inhibitions. Perhaps, he mused, perhaps when I return, if I am at Nasuada's table or King Orin's and meat is served, perhaps, if I feel like it, and it would be rude to refuse, I might have a few bites. I won't eat the way I used to, but neither shall I be as strict as the elves. Moderation is a wiser policy than zealotry, I think. By the light from the coals in the oven, Aragorn studied Sloane's hands. The butcher lay a yard or two away where Aragorn had placed him. Dozens of thin white scars crisscrossed his long, bony fingers, with their oversized knuckles and long fingernails that, while they had been meticulous in Carvajal, were now ragged, torn, and blackened with accumulated filth. The scars testified to the relatively few mistakes Sloane had made during the decades he had spent wielding knives. His skin was wrinkled and weathered and bulged with worm-like veins, yet the muscles underneath were hard and lean. Aragorn sat on his haunches and crossed his arms over his knees. "I can't just let him go," he murmured. If he did, Sloane might track down Roran and Katrina, a prospect that Aragorn considered unacceptable. Besides, even though he was not going to kill Sloane, he believed the butcher should be punished for his crimes. Aragorn had not been close friends with Bert, but he had known him to be a good man, honest and steadfast, and he remembered Bert's wife, Felda, and their children with some fondness, for Garrow, Roran, and Aragorn had eaten and slept in their house on several occasions. Bert's death, then, struck Aragorn as being particularly cruel, and he felt the Watchman's family deserved justice, even if they never learned about it. What, however, would constitute proper punishment? "I refuse to become an executioner," thought Aragorn, "only to make myself an arbiter. What do I know about the law?" Rising to his feet, he walked over to Sloane and bent toward his ear and said, "Vakna." With a jolt, Sloane woke, scrabbling at the ground with his sinewy hands. The remnants of his eyelids quivered as by instinct the butcher tried to lift them and look at his surroundings. Instead, he remained trapped in his own personal night. Aragorn said, "Here, eat this." He thrust the remaining half of his lizard toward Sloane, who, although he could not see it, surely must have smelled the food. "Where am I?" asked Sloane. With trembling hands, he began to explore the rocks and plants in front of him. He touched his torn wrists and ankles, and appeared confused to discover that his fetters were gone. The elves, and also the riders in days gone by, called this place Myrnathor. The dwarves referred to it as Wergharden, and humans as the Grey Heath, If that does not answer your question, then perhaps it will if I say we are a number of leagues southeast of Helgrind, where you were imprisoned.